The shift is instantaneous. It is as if the day after her death, a van pulls up outside my house and men start unloading luggage onto the pavement. "Oi," I say, "hang on a sec, none of that's mine." "Sorry, love," says the man, "someone has to have it." What can I say? "Okay, bring it in." I had asked my dad, groping for a language, any language, in which to talk about these things we'd never talked about, if she had said much to him. "Yes," he said. "She mentioned it a long time ago. There had been some kind of abuse, violence, and worse, and that's all he knew too." Like a veteran returning from the First World War, my mother had maintained, in her marriage as in her life, a hard line on revisiting the past. She was the gatekeeper, and she kept the gates shut. My dad had respected that. I said something like, "Obviously her dad was a weirdo." My dad said something like, "That would be putting it mildly." And with that, we reached the limit of what either of us was able to say. The day after her death, I had rung her sister Faye in Johannesburg. "Dying just isn't the sort of thing my mother would do," I said glibly, and Faye laughed. "No, it isn't." My aunt told me a bit about her life, her grown-up children and grandchildren, her routine. Like all my mother's siblings, she wasn't married and hadn't been for a long time. Every morning, she told me, she got up at the crack of dawn to go out and feed the birds in her garden. "That's so funny," I said. "My mum does that too." "Your mother had a lot of time for Faye," said my dad in the kitchen that evening. "I'd like to go there," I said, "to South Africa, to see them." He said that sounded like a good idea. "I offered to go," said my dad, "but Mum always said no." It is raining when I arrive. A mild English rain, not the African downpour my mother had threatened. In the early morning drizzle, we drive through suburbs that look like Milton Keynes or Houston to an aggressively bland hotel in the north of the city. I've been deliberately hazy about my arrival date. I am aware that what I'm about to do is unfair, flying halfway around the world to bother other people's parents with questions I'd been too afraid to ask my own. I'm also aware of the license I have. I'm the bereaved. I can do whatever I like and no one can say anything. The hotel room is dimly lit and perfectly climate controlled. The only distinguishing detail, a note on my bed left by hotel management, advising me against leaving the premises alone on foot. My mother would have had a fit. "Is it safe there?" I go through the old catechism in my head now. "Of course it's safe. It's a hotel. There's a lock on the door. But if there's a fire, can you still get out?" The phone rings for a long time before someone picks up. "Hello?" The voice is faint. My heart drops like the cable snapped. Faye and I have spoken several times by now. There should be no taboo in it. But ringing from a distance of a few miles seems a different proposition to ringing her from England. I've come all this way to claim a connection everyone else involved might think expired long ago. "Faye, it's Emma."
"Emma?"
Her voice soars. "Are you here?"
"I'm here."
"It's just so wonderful you're here," she says. Her voice is low and quiet. There is an urgency to the conversation. "I'm glad I'm here." Faye doesn't know precisely where all her siblings are, but there is a chain of command which they can, if necessary, be reached, and which is how news of my mother's death spread. Since leaving Johannesburg, her sister Doreen has sold all her furniture and become practically a nomad.
"I couldn't," says Faye. "I need the, what's the word, security."
"What about Tony?" I ask.
"Tony is Tony. He means well. It just doesn't always come out right."
"And Stephen?"
"Stephen is Stephen."
I sit on the edge of the bed in the gathering gloom. The only light in the room is from the spots above the minibar and the glowing LED of the alarm clock.
My aunt tells me about these people I have heard of all my life. Of everyone, I think, Faye will tell me what I want to know. You know your mother was called Pauline before she changed it to Paula, says my aunt. Yes, I know. Faye says this was because the first thing she did when she got off the boat in England was to buy a pair of shoes, and the label in them said Paula, so that's what she called herself. I laugh indulgently. My mother would never have named herself after a pair of shoes. She changed her name because she always thought Pauline was soppy. Several times, we push up against the boundaries of what can and cannot be said, buffeting and retreating like a boat trying to dock in bad weather. I tell my aunt I need a few days to settle in, and we arrange to meet at the weekend. Towards the end of the conversation, my aunt says, I feel terrible. I never knew her mother's name. I sometimes forget they had different mothers. So absent from my mother's narrative was her stepmother. Faye has barely mentioned Marjorie either. Her mother's name was Sarah, I say. Sarah, says my aunt. Faye asks me what I'm doing the following day. Oh, I say vaguely, this and that. The thing I had concealed from my aunt is that the following day, I'm going to hire a car and driver from the front desk and go to the National Archive in Pretoria. The next morning is overcast again. Outside the foyer, security men in yellow vests mill redundantly around. When the maroon BMW pulls up, I shake hands with the driver, who introduces himself as Paul. Pretoria, the capital, is not known for its charm. Johannesburg has the charm, the guile and energy, although I have yet to see any of it. We pull off an arterial road into a leafy car park and Paul lets me out. He promises to be back at the allocated time. Purpose of visit, says the man. Family tree. He looks down at my passport and back up at me. Then he waves me through, towards the double airlock doors. The reading room is low tech. A card index system in one corner, a bank of photocopiers against the wall. The procedure seems to be to fill in a slip, then wait in your seat until your order is brought up from the vaults. Every now and then, a woman with a grey bun wheels a trolley across the floor, unloads a pile of ledgers and leaves again, whereupon from all corners of the reading room, elderly men in khaki shorts fly over to raid what she's left, like beetles carrying off cubes of sugar. Calmly, I sit and wait. And while I wait, I watch these quiet, elderly people grazing over open ledges. Some of them have put on ties and jackets to come here. Good, kind people, I think, researching their family trees to pass on to their grandchildren and redeem in themselves a sense of continuity and purpose. The first shock is that a file matching my request comes up from the vaults. The second shock is logistical. When I walk over to the table and find it, I see that photocopying it will be out of the question. It's a huge ledger, labelled on the spine with a single year and containing every court case heard in the district in that period. I haul it back to the table and, looking at the clock, see I have 2 hours to transcribe whatever I find by hand. I have no month to go by and start paging through from the beginning. It is like playing a game of Russian roulette, each page balanced before it turns on the split-second possibility of an explosion in my face. A couple of breaking and enterings, a Mrs. Potgieter molested in her own home, a long, legal debate on what does and does not constitute rape. Mrs. Potgieter's assailant got 25 years, but he was black, and it becomes apparent, after 30 or so pages, that the only successfully prosecuted trials were ones such as these. The legalistic relish for the black man attacking the white woman rises off the page like mist. I'm so engrossed in Mrs. Potgieter and her troubles that when, 3/4 of the way in, I turn a page and see my mother's name, I don't keel off my chair, but take it as more or less part of the continuum. 2 words leap out on the summary page. Incest. And not guilty. Incest. My mother never used that word. I've never even used it in my head. I look up to see if anyone is watching me. I look down at the page again. I take in the name of the prosecutor, Britz, and the defendant, acting for himself. The case has been brought, I see, not in my mother's name, but in my aunt's. Of course. At 25, my mother was too old to be medically useful. I do the maths. Faye was 12. It takes me a few moments to figure out what I'm reading. There seem to be two charge sheets and two cover sheets recording verdicts from two different trials. In one, my grandfather is found guilty. In the other, not guilty. They are separated by a period of several months. I finally figure out what this signifies. The passage of the case from the preliminary hearing at a local court to the High Court in Johannesburg. He was found guilty at the first hearing and not guilty at the second. I flip the pages back and forth. Guilty, not guilty. Guilty, not guilty. On such words, entire life histories turn. I flip the page and the first hearing begins. There is a list of witnesses with my mother's name near the bottom. I see that her youngest sister, then 7 years old, was required to appear as a witness. Her stepmother is the first witness. A few pages in, there are two sets of diagrams, cross-sections of the human body beneath the names of the 12 and 7-year-old, with arrows alongside, which a court surgeon has signed. It takes a moment for me to make sense of them. Oh. Injuries. I look up from the page. Over the next 2 hours, I transcribe the notes, shoulders hunched, hand cramping, brain disengaged. When I get to the end of the first trial, I turn a page to find a sheaf of shorthand notes, the original court records. I get to the end of these, and there's nothing more. There are no records from the second trial. It will be impossible to tell how the testimony's changed. I leave the reading room, cross the car park, and to the concern of the guards in the booth, say I'm going for a walk. I turn left and blindly climb a hill, which it turns out leads to the Parliament buildings. These are large, classical structures with a panoramic view over Pretoria. Opposite is a small garden behind a chain-link fence. I step over the fence and sit on a bench looking out over Pretoria in the direction of Johannesburg. There are large red flowers which I think I recognise as protea. Flightless birds hop about on the lawn. I am exhilarated. I have read the contents of the file and yet here I am, alive, sitting on a bench in the afternoon sun. I experience a surge of vindictive triumph and conduct a long exchange in my head with the dead man, whom I don't permit to speak. Right, you bastard. You can answer to me now. This is mine, all of this. I am driving it now.
She Left Me the Gun by Emma Brox was abridged by Pete Nichols and read by Alison Pettit. The producer was Karen Rose, and it's a Sweet Talk production for BBC Radio 4. In a moment, we'll join Sian Williams for Radio 4's coverage of the ceremonial procession and funeral of Baroness Thatcher. And James Naughtie will provide commentary on the service from St Paul's Cathedral. That's from 10 o'clock to midday. And then it's you and yours after the midday news.
He was probably one of the first feminists.
Tracy Emin on Vermeer's painting, A Lady Writing a Letter with Her Maid.
He actually showed women doing things. He showed women writing letters. He showed that women had singular thoughts that were away from their husbands. He also showed that women didn't exactly have the same sort of class values as their husbands or men. He just showed women in a very, very good contemporary light.
75 creative minds share their inspiring moments in cultural exchange. New to Front Row, from next Monday at 7:15 on BBC Radio 4.